going to talk to you about today is a few things. The first is, I suppose, just painting a particular picture or analysis of some of the challenges that we face in providing integrated person-centered responses for people with dementia. So the kind of work that we've been hearing about this morning. I'm going to talk about what we call dementia consortia, or a consortium as one solution. So I'll be talking about what that is and how it works. And I'm going to refer to two, I think, you know, very interesting and promising emerging ways of working or fields of study, and they are collective impact and people-powered health. So the starting point, and this is very similar to Steve's first slide, in fact, our starting point has to be how we view dementia. What's our position on this? So if it's solely viewed, you know, as a medical condition or disease, you know, I think that's incredibly limiting. And I think, you know, the discourse is really about something that it's much wider than that. And there are many other dimensions and considerations, and we've been hearing about some of them this morning. So there's the personal and family, and the emotional dimensions and fallout, the wider community and their role, the overall social context and the environmental context. So essentially the biopsychosocial approach that Steve was talking about. And if we embrace this fully, this really shapes our response. So dementia is a multidimensional phenomenon, if you like, and I suppose I argue that it needs a multidimensional response. Some of the challenges that we face in doing this is that there are multiple actors or stakeholders or bodies or agencies or services, and I'll talk a little bit about that. That there are gaps in service provision and a lack of integration, partly because of that multiplicity of bodies. As here in Ireland, certainly, we have a misalignment of our stated policy and our service provision, and, you know, arguably an unsustainable current service model. So these are, I suppose, significant challenges, but depending on how we approach them, they also present, actually, as opportunities, I think. So to just consider that multiplicity of actors, if you like, because dementia is usually or often a long-term condition, and it has, you know, a deteriorating trajectory, if we layer on top of that the fact that many people with dementia will have other illnesses or diseases, and it's the fact that dementia is multidimensional, as I've described, both in terms of its impact and, you know, the potential ways in which we can intervene, the result is something like this in terms of, you know, from the point of view of the person and their family, the agencies, the health professionals and others that they may interact with in the course of their dementia journey. So, you know, if we think of the person, you know, in the centre, you know, being supported to live an included life and a valued person, how do we make this work when they have to interact with a range of actors from, you know, general practitioners and primary care, mental health services, acute hospitals, the range of home help and home support services. There are lots of other mainstream service organisations, community voluntary, you know, there's a multiplicity of potential actors. This is a real challenge for the person and the family in navigating this and trying to find their point of entry or their point of contact that really meets their needs at a point in time. It's also a big challenge for the providers and for this big range of agencies and actors, some of whom don't know a whole lot about dementia. And also there's a very little integration across these different agencies. I suppose ideally we would have a whole range of community supports, but this slide is kind of trying to represent the lack of continuum, if you like, of services and supports. And what we have is a kind of fairly limited range of supports in the community, supports and services, and a kind of an inexorable journey often to long-term residential care. As it happens, those two spheres really probably fairly accurately also represent the spend in terms of euro in those two areas. And there's a bit on this slide, and my colleague Hugh used this recently, we worked on it, but it's, I think it sums up a lot of issues very well. So our stated policy here, as in many other countries, is to really support older people to remain living at home for as long as possible. But if we look, if we compare the kind of what that's like in reality, on the residential care side, we spend about €1 billion a year supporting, you know, about 20,000 people, and about €400 million supporting the remainder of the over 65 population, essentially. If you enter residential care, if you're, you know, deemed suitable for a place, you get the kind of the full package of care, whether really you need all of that at that point or not. If you're still supported at home, you tend to get what's available rather than what you need. On the residential side, there's a certainty around it, and some would say a finality. You know, you have a place and you'll be there until you die. I shall go down this column on the residential side. At one level, it gives a lot of confidence for families. They know that their loved one is going to be in a place where they'll be cared for. It also, interestingly, gives, and we've been finding, certainly in the work with the hospitals, it gives a lot of confidence for the system in the sense that that's another person kind of taken care of. They'll be there. It may not be the person's choice at that point in time. And then on the community side, you know, as against the confidence that it gives for families, on the community side, there's often an insufficient level of support and a lack of certainty around the quantity of that and the availability of it. It can be unresponsive, inflexible, and often a bit late in intervening. And the evidence is, and what we know from talking to older people, is that they want to be supported at home for as long as possible. I think Katrina captured it very well on the piece of film earlier, you know. There's very few people saying, I really want to, you know, my ambition is to end up in a nursing home. So we really need to hear that. We really need to hear people's wishes and pay attention to them. And the way we've structured our services isn't really doing that at the moment. I'm going to talk about filthy lucre, I'm afraid, because that is a reality. And our current model, you know, is unsustainable for a number of reasons. We know we have increasing numbers of older people, and therefore we'll have increasing numbers of people with dementia. And the projections for Ireland are that the numbers of people with dementia will about double by 2026. We know that, you know, the kind of residential, long-term residential model of care is an expensive model of care. And we know that there are a lack of alternatives to that model. So where does all that analysis leave us, I suppose? So dementia is, it's a multidimensional issue. There are lots of actors and stakeholders involved. It's a long-term disorder, and people can often have other illnesses alongside it. There are gaps in services, and there's a lack of integration, and the unsustainability piece. I suppose all this leads to a conclusion that there's no single service or agency that has all of the expertise or resource within them to fully address the needs of the person if we really adopt that biopsychosocial model. So I suppose this is where Dementia Consortia come in. And this was the thinking and the type of analysis, I suppose, that informed the development of these consortia. It was really late 2011 that my colleague Hugh Kane and I, we were in the fortunate position of being supported by Atlantic Philanthropies and the Health Service Executive, who put some money together and said, you know, how can we come up with better community-based responses for people with dementia? And, you know, through that analysis, we realised, you know, there's no point in just trying to get a single body or agency to do all of this, that really we need to encourage the multiplicity of people involved to come together in a very purposeful and structured way. And this spawned the development or of these dementia consortia. And in that initial round, 18 groups came together to respond to that. So, you know, it was really interesting development and really useful. And I think what we're finding is that it's being taken up in other areas. So the area-based childhood programme that's been developed by the Centre for Effective Services is using a consortium approach because, again, if we think of services for children, there are a multiplicity of actors, you know, the schools, family support services and so on. And I think the recent forum on homelessness that was held here in the capital last week is probably a loose example of that also, of the recognition that there are lots of agencies out there, they're all doing something along the same lines. You know, can we bring everybody together and get a better response? So what is... Sorry, I go back to that for a second because I was talking and not really highlighting the benefits. So why is a consortium, you know, a potential solution? Well, it does bring all the interested stakeholders together in a very specific way, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. By its very nature, it increases integration. You know, what we hear from the consortia that we've supported so far is just the sort of face-to-face meeting between the different organisations and health and social care professionals working in the area, you know, increases, you know, kind of brings a better response about. And it creates a forum to develop new responses as a seedbed almost for new thinking. It helps reduce duplication and it's potentially a more cost-effective way of working. So what is it? It is a group, a large group. Crucially important, people with dementia and their carers are members of that group. Now, that may be indirectly in the case of people with dementia where, you know, there are different ways for their voice to be represented in a way that works for them, maybe through panels and so on. But they are centrally part of the process. All the statutory health and social care services for older people, GPs and primary care team members, the wide range of voluntary and community groups that work in the area, and also the ones we often don't think about, the mainstream agencies and organisations who have a role in supporting all older people in their area. So that's the county council, the Gardaí or the police force, family resource centres and so on. And then lots of others who show up and have an important role and something to offer. Transport is really key. We found that things like local radio and local media have been really important, particularly in rural Ireland. So it's a large collection of lots of different bodies and agencies. How does it work? Well, strong leadership is really important, and a particular type of leadership, I suppose, that's facilitative, that isn't about, you know, having the answer to everything, but encouraging all the organisations to come up with the best solution and in a very inclusive way. In terms of the mechanics of it, the consortia have developed their own agreed governance structures and a memorandum of understanding on how they'll work together to achieve agreed outcomes. They found that subgroups to address specific issues are really helpful. It does take lots of time. This isn't easy, and I don't want to convey the impression that this is another magic bullet to solve all of this. It does take time, and that needs to be factored into people's work. And it does require some resource to actually support the workings of such a diverse group. But it has been found to be really effective. So at the risk of this just being kind of death by meetings and just another committee to be a member of, and lots of people say, well, it's just another committee, isn't it? And we're already on, I'm in, you know, so many networks and I'm on other committees and coalitions and movements and partnerships. And yes, they are certainly all really useful ways for bodies and people to work together. But I would argue that this is quite different. And the way that it's different is that we draw on a body of work that really originated in the United States called Collective Impact. Probably Collective Action is a better term, but anyway, it's called Collective Impact. And this approach that's kind of developed quite organically, I think, to address, you know, what we might consider intractable social issues. So something that requires a system-wide response or a big response. And crucially, where one organization on its own can't achieve the changes required. It's not about introducing a new model or a new program necessarily. It really is a different way of working. And I think it's come about through this realization that really any kind of large-scale social change, it really comes from better cross-sector coordination rather than the isolated intervention of separate organizations. It's been used very effectively in the area of education in particular in the US, and some really striking examples of collectives over there. There are five conditions that have been defined for collective success. I'm not going to talk about all of them, but I will talk about two of them because I think they're probably really important and kind of make a lot of intuitive sense. The first is a common agenda, and it can be a kind of an assumption that we make when we bring together a group of people around a table that we're all here for the same purpose. But actually, when you start interrogating that, you can find that, maybe I thought we were really here to be kind of going a little bit in this direction, and another organization is really thinking about going a little bit in this direction, and so on. So, the consortia come together around a shared vision for change and for action, if you like, and really tease out and work towards a common understanding of the issue. And this can take time, but it's part of a process that's really well worth undertaking because it helps everybody to actually understand everybody else's perspective much better and to make sure that there is an agreement around this kind of shared vision. What follows from that then is an agreed set of actions for solving that or for addressing that issue through a joint approach. And all the participants really need to agree on the goals, on the outcomes, as Hugh was mentioning at the very beginning. This is about agreed outcomes and really working quite relentlessly towards those outcomes. And those outcomes are based on better outcomes for the people involved. The other, I think, really interesting feature of this is this idea of mutually reinforcing activities. I think this graphic probably captures it quite well. So it is about working together, but not necessarily doing the exact same thing. So, a primary care team have a very specific set of actions, and they have a very specific purpose. And a community or a voluntary group has also a very specific purpose. That's quite different. So it's not about everybody just trying to do the same thing. Really, each participating organisation does what they do best, but aligned with achieving the agreed goal. So everybody is working in alignment. I suppose one example of this is maybe information or awareness campaigns around dementia. So you could have at any kind of geographical area at any one time lots of interested organisations doing lots of things around awareness raising that, because they're not necessarily uncoordinated, they might overlap, they might duplicate, the messaging might be slightly different, and all the evidence around how you communicate tells us that that's not a really good way to get a message across. Using the same resource and in a very kind of coordinated way and a mutually reinforcing way, it can be agreed that actually we'll have a wave of communication so that every month, an organisation is putting out an agreed message, that is presenting the same information or presenting a really clear agreed message. That'll have much more impact than a kind of much more diffuse and potentially overlapping and duplicating effort. Again, it's potentially really powerful, but it's not easy. I suppose one of the particular challenges is that Particularly for organizations that, you know, community and voluntary organizations who need to create their own profile and have ownership of their activities, because that relates to how they raise funds. Having to kind of seed their, you know, particular stamp on an activity can be difficult. But I think, and you can, you know, the identities that are formed around the consortia, they've become really well known. And I think being associated with that effort is I think, a good payoff for that. The other thing I want to just talk briefly about is something called people-powered health. And this is, I had come across it through something called co-production. And it's, again, a kind of a growing and an emerging area. It's essentially about putting people more in control of their own health and well-being, and trying to overcome fragmentation through a different focus on community resources and those resources in the widest sense. I suppose the drivers essentially are, and these are common certainly across kind of Western world health services, are financial pressures on public health services. You know, there's increasing realisation that, you know, there is more need than our resources will ever meet. You know, if we spent all of our, you know, if we combined the health, education and whatever else budget and spent it all on health, we still wouldn't meet all the need that's out there. And coupling that with what we know is a significant increase in long-term health conditions, there's a sense that maybe we should be looking again at how we provide health and social care services. And this, it's not necessarily a movement, I suppose it's a way of thinking about how we deliver services called People Power Health is developing. It really represents a very significant transformation and speaks very directly to what Steve was talking about earlier. Crucial, you know, central to it is recognizing people as assets rather than needs. So the health, you know, the health system looking at the people who are coming through the door as potential assets rather than a set of needs to be addressed. And really importantly, building on people's existing capabilities and strengths. And I think Steve again spoke about that. It promotes mutuality and reciprocity. So again, it speaks to viewing the person as somebody with a lot of capabilities, with a contribution to make. Everybody has something to offer. You know, Steve gave the example earlier of, you know, people with dementia going into the, you know, the early child centre, and we've lots of examples of that across the consortia, and also in our work in disability and mental health, where everybody has something to offer, and it's about finding that and really building on it. For this to work, we really need to kind of break down those barriers between professionals and recipients or patients, and I think you know, again, Steve discussed this very eloquently this morning. You know, it's not about a patient-professional relationship, but really co-partners in seeking the best outcomes and facilitating rather than delivering. If we deliver a service, it immediately puts the receiver in a passive position with no say, the non-expert who has to kind of take what they get, basically. There's a realisation that this doesn't necessarily give us the best outcomes. And in case you think that this just sounds very kind of fluffy and motherhood and apple pie and isn't that lovely and we'd all love to do that, this is the NHS 5-year forward view, and this is central to how they see their services developing in the next 5 years. This is how they are going to be moving forward. And to, again, bring it back to how we pay for all of this, this quote is probably one of the reasons why the NHS is beginning to pay so much attention to it. And again, Nesta is a really interesting think tank in the UK. I'd recommend their website. But they did a review of the evidence, which is still in its very early days, but even on what they could identify, you know, they estimate there's a potential savings of $4.4 billion a year. Now, the NHS spends a lot. By adopting these innovations that involve patients, their families and communities more directly in the management of long-term health conditions. It's a quote, so management was in there already, Steve. It it really works around kind of five areas of practice. This idea of it's more than medicine. So essentially, you know, a biopsychosocial approach. People helping people, redefining consultations. This is how we engage with people who need services and support. You know, do we do a kind of a needs assessment that's just going to focus completely on deficits, or do we find out who is this person who's presenting? What's their relationship context? What's their family context? What's the context that shapes them? It talks about networks and partnerships, and this is again where dementia consortia fit in completely. And really importantly, user co-design and co-delivery. So the person as an expert in what it is they need and how that should be delivered. So just to try and summarise that, I've just kind of pulled out the key features of these different models or these different ways of thinking about collective impact, people-powered health, and how they're encapsulated in this idea of a consortium working together. So networks and partnerships, a common agenda, user co-design and co-delivery. And it really combines, I think the consortia really combined the power of new thinking and new action. Touch on this, the outcomes, our experience of this way of working is that we've 13 dementia consortia have come together and are working really well around the country. And, you know, in both in hospital and community-based services, at the moment, over 800 people with dementia and carers are directly benefiting. Eight of those consortia are in the very early days, so there's a whole wave of numbers to come through there. And again, these aren't just talking shops, real services and I think really good services, as Suzanne was describing earlier this morning, are delivered. Over 28,000 hours of individualised, really individualised, person-centred supports have been delivered so far, as well as many other supports and interventions that I'm not going to detail now. So just to summarise and some reflections, I think the idea of coming together in a very particular way, we've called it dementia consortia. You could put any other name on it you like, is really, we've found it to be really powerful. And I suppose it's because it harnesses the power of all the members so that the result is really much greater than the sum of its parts. It gives diverse agencies a role of equal value, but recognises the unique contribution of each agency. It involves the person and the family centrally and equally. They decide what it is they need. It releases lots of other resources that, you know, aren't commonly thought of as a resource, you know, from the point of view of the health sector, which tends to focus very much on what they can do, what they can provide. Once we broaden out that lens, the resource that's out there is quite significant. Is this way of working challenging? Yes, definitely. Is it just about cutting costs and shifting the burden of responsibility onto people? I think it could be viewed in that way. But I think it does speak to the need that people have to be much more empowered, to have a much greater say in what it is that they get and how they're supported. And I think if people really do want to be involved in their care, this is one way of doing it. Is it the only way? Probably not. There are probably lots of other ways of doing this. But it does represent a way of, I think, addressing the challenges that I spoke about earlier and present at the beginning. And if we choose to view them as opportunities, you know, there is lots of new thinking emerging that gives us the tools so that we can embrace those opportunities rather than ignore them as challenges that are just too big for us to tackle. So the challenge for us is whether we're really brave enough to move up, to move to what is possibly a new paradigm, viewing people as assets, viewing people as contributors, and working with them as partners in delivering a new form of health and social care.